Talk given Sunday, 26th January, 1975. Life is action. A great rhythm. And life energy is a continuous radiation. Every single life center, so to say, radiates out in every direction. Because life is the mysterious energy of which we know very, very little indeed. Life energy is an energy not merely in the biological sense, but in many other senses to which we still have to awake. And this energy radiates out continuously, in all directions. It's important to bear this in mind. It is impossible for the human brain to visualize this, to picture it. But we can get a feeling of it if we are very, very quiet and still. Now, this life rhythm functions in the subtlest way which we call spirit, the transcendent, the unknown, unknowable, or the absolute. We give it many names, but it is life. Life in the transcendent and religious sense. That is its subtlest expression, or shall I say, subtlest form, manifestation, as far as the human mind can reach. And then there is something less subtle, but which is and closer to us, which is at a mind level, the level of pure mind. And the level of pure mind as manifested in the human being in terms of psyche. And here at the level of psyche, it is in touch with its concretest expression, the physical body, physical manifestation. And by physical body, I don't mean merely our human bodies or animal bodies, but everything that we experience as solid stuff or matter generally. I shouldn't have said solid stuff, matter generally. Solid, liquid, gaseous, whatever it is. That is its concretest expression. Now this continuous radiation which goes on from every point of space, so to say, is a great harmony. It is a harmony which includes all the extremes that we experience in our dualistic way, as pleasant, as painful, as violent and explosive on the one hand, and smooth and easygoing on the other hand. The totality does not know anything, is not concerned with anything which is described in our dualistic terms. Violence is something which is special to us human beings because our psychical intellectual process categorizes certain grades of experience as explosive and violent and other grades as the opposite of explosive and violent. But we suffer from violence. And this is a very important point. The rest of the universe doesn't. The phenomena we see as mighty galactic explosions and so forth are named explosions and violent events by me, a human being. The galaxies don't call it violence. They probably are having great fun. Haven't you seen children in the playground, little children, thoroughly enjoying throwing things about, smashing up what they can do? They're very happy. Perhaps the galaxies are happy in that way. The divine energy in childish exuberance. No part of the cosmos ever suffers from this sense of frustration which we suffer from at being a nobody, as not being valued, as not being wanted by that which is around. It is only we human beings who suffer that way. The not wanted ones. And in the animal world too, we see this phenomenon. Because the psychical development of the animal, in several respects, is similar to ours. But the universe as a whole does not have any inferiority or superiority complex anywhere in it. I am a nobody. I am a failure. That doesn't afflict any part of the cosmos. It afflicts us. Because no part of the cosmos is egoistic. I am egoistic. Therefore, I suffer from these things. Therefore, also, I struggle and strive in competition with, or in downright antagonism to, others around me. And I try to bend the circumstance and other people to my will, hence producing conflict, unnecessary conflict, unnecessary sorrow and difficulty for myself. We have to feel this very, very quietly. If you ever enter into those deep states of meditation where you are really in tune with the environment, I'm using a small word, I really mean with the whole cosmos. When you're really in tune with it, then you will realize that there is no striving here, no quarreling. Everything just happens. And whatsoever happens is part of the great creative process of the universe. God is the one and only ego. Being the one and only ego, God is utterly unegoistic. And that one and only ego contains within itself the sum total of all the egos, the unique individual microcosms that constitute the great macrocosm, the totality. You see, the intellect can be of very great help if we see this clearly. It can be of very great help in calming our emotions, in bringing peace and strength to us as individuals, in such fashion that we do not fight with the environment, with other people, with the situation in which we find ourselves, nor do we quarrel inside our own being as regards our different qualities and the way they operate. So, there is peace in the soul, in the psyche, in the mind. Use whichever word you like. There is a peace which is associated with a poise and an indifference in the right sense, to all the challenges that the world throws at us, tempting us to express violence and egoism. I am somebody, I am nobody. They are both stupid extremes. They are not realities at all. Now, try and really let your whole mind absorb this, not merely as an idea, but as a fact of existence, of all existence. And then you will discover something quite extraordinary. It will happen to you. Don't look for it. It will happen. You will know the meaning of love. Where there is no egoism, where there is no violence, where there is such clear seeing, open-mindedness, open-heartedness, then you are at one with everything. And this at oneness with everything is the state of love, which is the supreme, creative, sustaining, nurturing, healing power of the universe. No one part of the universe falls in love or attempts to make love. It is only we human beings who are so backward, so absurd, that we try to make love. I, the finite, ignorant, clumsy creature, cannot make that which is transcendent, eternal, and absolute. We never seem to have woken up to that simple fact. One could almost say that anybody with any brains whatsoever should have seen it easily enough. But perhaps, in addition to our 10,000 million brain cells, we need two or three more in order to see that. You see, if we grasp this, if we understand it, how many of our problems vanish straight away? They just don't exist. Why? Because it is my own violence, my own ignorance, my own egoism, which keeps on producing the problems inside my own mind. They are not problems which are due to the external world or the external circumstance at all. I am their progenitor. In my own inner consciousness, I have nothing better to do than to make a mess. That is why these problems come into being. But see it, and you'll be immersed in this ocean, this immensity, this cosmic love. What happens then? There is nothing that you grasp at. It is not possible to grasp at that which is not other than you. Because if we awaken to this, the whole sense of otherness completely vanishes. What is there other? You? But who are you? Only another version of myself. Now, one has to be careful of a little trap here. If the intellect starts saying, oh, that person and that person and every other person is another version of myself, I am slightly in danger of having a very bloated ego. Therefore, you are another version of myself. I am another version of you. Each one. So, in that state, where there is the intense realization in the deeps of awareness that there is no otherness throughout the universe, one is at peace within, one is in harmony within oneself and with everything else. You remember I've said over and over again through the years, and this meeting ends our first 13 years. Next time we meet, the 14th year begins. You remember I've said over and over again that the whole story of spiritual unfoldment is the transformation of your mode of awareness of existence. I start life aware of myself and the so-called not-self in a certain way. And that way is the way of the ignorant, the unskilled, and so on. The one who is grasping, who is chasing after butterflies, and so on. That mode of awareness undergoes a complete transformation. And here mind and heart both come into play in order that that transformation may take place. And when that transformation has taken place, the real conversion, the real metanoia has come into being, then this terrible ache of separation from totality has vanished. You are at one with it. In the process of that transformation, there takes place the purification, the complete purification of the entire being, the organism, the psychophysical organism. And the whole story of what we call development and the religious discipline and so forth is enacted on the stage of the world in which we live. That whole drama takes place there. You are the dramatist. You are the drama. You are the stage. You are the onlooker. Yourself. That you must realize. So you see, your immense self-responsibility. Now, we must understand very clearly that this self-responsibility is not the responsibility to myself felt as, conceived as, a person separate from all other persons, separate from the world. That is not self-responsibility. That self-responsibility, that sense of self-responsibility always introduces egoistic action, self-oriented action. I've got to do this. This is my duty. On me falls the burden. It all depends on me. What a wonderful big frog I am. No, not that way. You see, this perishing, temporary self is in complete relationship with the total being. And it is self as the totality which is the self in that term, self-responsibility. Remember this. This is very important. And you work it out for yourself. And see the immense consequences which follow a realization of this fact. Then you see, there is no such thing as my self-responsibility. I am aware of the totality, the total self, the one and only self, if we may use the word self, you see, to which every single individual unique manifestation is completely related. Do you get it? Understand it. Now you see, aware of self-responsibility in that way, there is nothing which comes out of us in thought and feeling, speech and action, which will contravene love in its specifically human forms. What is one of the supreme difficulties where love is concerned? We all have our own conceptions of it, which are every one of which is a misconception, insofar as it is a finite thought form. And we are all at the same time driven by our natural urges in order to satisfy that which we lump under the name of love. The heart is unruly. The mind is stupid. And between the stupid mind and the unruly heart, eros, love in the supreme sense, nothing to do with the word erotic, remember, but eros, the creator of the universe, that is his first meaning, this creative power. Eros suffers continual crucifixion. Try and feel this with tremendous intensity. And when I say try, try is a bad word, but still, it's difficult to use a perfect word for matters like this. Feel with complete intensity the reality of this thing. And you will find so much pain, misery, sorrow disappearing out of your life altogether. What comes from, as we ordinarily say, what comes from outside, we cannot control. If there is an earthquake, that's on the vast scale, or if a little rascal of a schoolboy, age 8, takes a delight in dropping a stone from the 4th floor onto your head as you pass by under the street, it will hurt. And no nonsense about it. Of course it will hurt. That sort of hurt inevitably comes in life. No one can avoid it. You can stumble on the pavement and be laid up for weeks. That hurts. But this unnecessary hurt, which we ourselves, because of the confused mind, the stupid mind, and the unruly heart, this is what we can completely control. And the control is through understanding. Feel this creative energy of the universe, this life rhythm in action. And let the mind see that this is of the very substance of what we name love. The creating, sustaining, nurturing, healing, renewing energy. And if you and I are in tune with that, then love permeates our life. And the pain of the heart and the mind ceases. Now, I've said so much along these lines because I would like to relate it to something which Buddhists particularly know of and practice, what are called the Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings. They are regarded as modes of meditation. But what I have already said so far should help us not to limit the Brahma Vihara to particular modes of meditation. 6 o'clock breakfast. 6:30, Brahma Vihara meditation. Or if you are a little more skillful, you'll make Brahma Vihara meditation first and breakfast afterwards. That is only slightly less foolish. Your Brahma Viharic state has to be a permanent condition. How many marriages have thrived on? Now then, Laring, 7 o'clock, love time. 8 o'clock. Oh, look, I must be off now. I've got so much to do. Wasn't Puck right? Lord, what clever people these mortals be. Now, look at these Brahma Viharas. They come in Buddhist teaching usually in two situations. One situation is as follows. Some sincere, keen Brahmin, and usually he's a youth. Not always, but usually. He's a youth. And he comes to visit the Buddha. And in the course of the conversation, the term the Brahma Loka, residing in the Brahma Loka, or union with Brahma, crops up. Now remember that in the lifetime of the Buddha himself used the word Brahma, the neuter, as well as Brahma, the masculine singular, to signify just what Brahmanical India understood by it. Brahma is the father god, the creator of all things. And the idea of creation is associated with the Father God, it is associated with the idea of the act of love. It is love in action which creates. All creative activity is love in action. You see? So, when the Brahmin youth says, "Ah, Lord, you mentioned the Brahma Loka, it would be good if the Blessed Lord would teach me, show me the way to union with Brahma, union with the Father God, the mystic union, the Unio Mystica," and we have it in Christian mysticism par excellence, because one of the supreme things in Christian mysticism is the realization of the love of God and the love with God. In fact, a fair amount of Christian mystical experience is expressed in erotic imagery in relation to this. See? All right. And then the Buddha, seeing that this young man is ready and ripe for such things, gives out the teaching of the Brahma Viharas. What comes in the discourses, in the long discourses, as well as in the middle-length discourses, is generally presented in this form. The person fills his mind with loving kindness, metta, the Pali word, fills his mind with loving kindness. He suffuses himself with loving kindness, and he extends that afterwards to the whole of one quarter. They just say one quarter, meaning one quarter of the world. Suffuses that with loving kindness. And then the second quarter. And then the third quarter. And the fourth quarter. Above, across, and below. And he goes on to add, so that that loving kindness, that metta, has grown great, become far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable. This is very, very significant. See, the entire cosmos becomes included. It goes on to the next statement. He does the same with compassion. karuna, compassion, fills his own mind with compassion, spreads it through all the quarters, above, across, below, till it has become far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable. And the third is sympathetic joy, gladness, mudita, at the success of anyone whatsoever, including oneself, the gladness at the success of anyone in having realized that which brings true happiness. This is not sufficiently extensively explained in the texts as such. It just says, delighting in the happiness of others. But all over the world, you have millions of people in the locals experiencing what they call happiness. I don't think the Buddha would have been quite in agreement with that. The happiness that the texts refer to is the happiness that inevitably is there, which is not suppressed by my stupidity and folly. But whatsoever is realized of truth, whatsoever liberation is experienced by oneself, is the state of happiness and is cause for happiness. So, gladness that such happiness is there and spreads. And the last point, after mudita, happiness, is upekkha, which is equanimity, perfect mindfulness. I'm going to use the same word which I used earlier. Indifference is its first meaning. Complete indifference to the values of the world. Worldly values no longer influence the person who is concerned with truth, with fact, with reality, with being human and not remaining subhuman or bestial. This is the meaning of indifference in that context. It certainly does not mean being unconcerned with others. Because if that were the case, then it makes nonsense of loving kindness and compassion. What place has loving kindness and compassion if one is taught to be indifferent to other human beings and so forth? You see? So this is the meaning of that indifference. And because one is untouched by the misdirection of the energies of human beings in the world, one is untouched by it, you are untouched by the violence and the stupidity and the horror of the world, therefore you are completely mindful, completely wide awake, and your loving kindness, your compassion, your gladness is an effective form in which life energy clothes itself and expresses love at the human level, the truly human level. That means at the level of the one in whom evil-mindedness is completely extirpated, completely burnt out. Now, you find these teachings given a more detailed exposition, particularly in the Visuddhimagga of Buddha Gosha, who flourished 9 centuries after the Buddha. He must have been a very remarkable person, really. And there you get, as you'll also find in the Anguttara Nikaya and other Buddhist sources, a few more explanatory statements. Now the statements go in this fashion. When you start the meditation, first of all, you contemplate the dangers and the evils of hate in any and every form. Malevolence, ill will, anger, impatience, the constant criticism of this, that and the other. That doesn't mean one shouldn't perceive the bad as the bad and the evil as the evil. One perceives it. But when, in addition to the perceiving, there is an emotion which goes against it, and there is a condemnation of it, then that's an act of hate. You see, that's the difference. So one contemplates the dangers of hate and sees that all hate must be put aside. Then one sees the beauty of patience and forbearance. You will find in the Dhammapada, I think it is verse 184, I'm not certain. Somewhere there. Patience and forbearance are extolled as the supreme tapo, the supreme austerity. It is sometimes translated as austerity. I like to translate it as the supreme mindfulness. For this reason, the Sanskrit word is tapas, and it means getting warm, hotting up. But how do you hot up? And what is it that is being hotted up? Your attention becomes so concentrated that it begins to glow, and your whole psyche is glowing. You get the idea? You get the feel of it. And this is tapas. And this is examination in the meaning of the word examination, where religious discipline is concerned. It is not merely the cold, dispassionate observation of a scientist looking at what is happening in the course of his experiment. That is only part of the story with the religious discipline. The other part is that when the attention glows, the whole psyche warms up to it, glows with this observation. And when the psyche glows with the observation and you penetrate into the truth becomes part of you. That heat, that psychical heat, wells what is outside you into your own being. You become the truth. So you see, patience and forbearance are two specially extolled qualities in association with this. After that, you let the mind become extremely peaceful. Remember, by this time you are very wide awake. The mind becomes very peaceful, and in that quiet state, all pleasure drives, pleasure lust, all malevolence, all sloth, torpor, worry and flurry, and all sorts of stupid doubts just go out. Now the mind and the heart are clean. They are ready to enter the Brahma Viharas. Now they say, fill your mind with loving kindness. But you see, you don't take a jug or something and dip it into the bucket of loving kindness and pour it into onto your head, hoping it will go through to your brain. Nothing of the sort. When the attentiveness has got to this stage, and you are in the clean, pure condition, you yourself are the unresisting focus of this universal energy of love throughout the cosmos, which manifests as loving kindness. You give it the name loving kindness because as it goes through the crucible of your own psyche and your own human experience, you know what loving kindness is. Therefore, you, the person, give that shape to this energy. Otherwise, what do? You merely go through a mumble of words, don't you? This is what has to happen as a live experience, a living energy, a living power. And then you will find that your whole being is suffused with loving kindness, first for yourself, suffused, permeated. Your being takes it in, and it takes it in not like merely like a sponge. All you've got to do is to squeeze the sponge and out goes your loving kindness. And doesn't that happen every day in our lives? How easily? All right. So the whole being becomes permeated with this energy and it absorbs it. And your whole psychophysical being undergoes transformation. You just let transcendence work through you. Mine is the task to clean the temple, throw wide open all doors and windows. Best of all, to let the temple not be inside any enclosed building, but out in the open of the whole cosmos. That is why the holy ones, time and again, whenever possible, always sought nature and the solitude of nature, where it is so much easier to be in harmony with the infinitude of the cosmos. Right, so this fills your own being. And now, when it fills your own being in that way, if you are really attentive, wide awake, this is the important point. It is your wide awakeness that inevitably allows that energy to flow out into the total environment. This business of filling the first quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter, the fourth quarter, and all the rest of it is only a way of talking about it. Now, in the more detailed explanations, they say, you say to yourself, may I be well, at ease, free from ill, free from enmity, malevolence, and so forth. But you see, we have to start that way in order to get the idea at all. But what do we do in actual practice? We just go on mumbling those words, in the same old fashion as we go on mumbling, you know, I believe in God the Father, etc., 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 and having mumbled, you say, I've said my prayers, I'm such a good fellow, now God will look after me. And if he doesn't, I'm not going to church again. No, not a mumble of words, but this is what we have to beware of. It has to be a real experiencing inside yourself. And then the whole thing happens like that. Now, when you are in that state, remember that your psycho-mental processes are at their supreme level, functioning with immense energy and power. Now, if you call up somebody who is suffering, All you do is to call that person up by name in mind. The name has extraordinary power. If you know the person, you can visualize the person, all right. You can direct loving kindness, you can direct compassion, you can direct gladness to that person. Simply by calling him up in mind, nothing else. Don't think, oh, he's in Sydney, Australia, now I'll send this energy of loving kindness, you know, at 186,000 miles a second, speed of light business, you know, to Sydney. Not a bit of it. It's here, right here. You don't have to send it anywhere. You see, this doctrine of the interpenetration of all particulars is an extraordinary doctrine. Modern science, if you please, in the last 15 years has come to this stage also. But I won't digress and talk about that now. It's an extraordinary thing. Anything contains within itself the total cosmos. Everything in the cosmos contains every other thing of the cosmos in it. You can't picture it, you can't imagine it, don't try to. You'll lose all the hair on your head and never get at it if you try to imagine it. Take the words as they are. Don't merely believe them. Don't reject them out of hand. But if you keep the mind open, something magical will go on inside your being, and you will understand it. And because of this great interpenetration, the use of the name is sufficient to let that energy go to that person. And that's all, nothing else. Don't give any shape to it. I hope he'll be able to make investments in such and such stocks in order to make up for the £100,000 loss he has had recently. You'll go to hell yourself for that sort of folly, and you'll send him also to hell. I mean what I say. Don't do it. Just call up the person and let that person be pervaded by the reality of love. That is all. Then you don't interfere with karma. You do not suffer from the conceit that you are an agent of the divine or the transcendent. The transcendent has no agencies anywhere. Otherwise, it wouldn't be transcendent. I mean, these are very deep and serious things. We need not be long-faced and solemn about them, but we must be very serious about them. And then whatsoever is to happen will happen in the rightest possible way. Now, these Brahma-viharic meditations are intimately bound up with entering and realizing the deep states of consciousness. Remember, they stand for the union with Brahma. Where the unio mystica is a realized fact, your mode of awareness of existence has undergone the supreme transformation, hasn't it? It's very important to understand this. And that last aspect, the upekkha, which is a state of perfect mindfulness, perfect clarity, utter indifference in the sense of being unaffected by the evil of the world, is the state in which you yourself are the totally empty one, empty of all ill. You are transparent then. Your whole being is transparent. And on those occasions in the lives of the holy ones, when that transparency became so intense that it effected an actual change in their bodily appearance, the transfiguration took place. You see what wonders love can do. That reality of love, not what we mortals in our folly call love. You will find that you go right beyond all limitation, grown great. Remember that term in each of these Brahma-viharic meditations. Grown great, far-reaching, immeasurable. If it is immeasurable, then it belongs to the levels of what we call akasha and vijnana. The infinity of akasha is usually translated as space, which is, space is a misleading word. But look into the writings and study for yourself what akasha really means and could mean. You enter into that infinity of akasha and vijnana, consciousness, discriminative consciousness. But in entering the infinity of discriminative consciousness, you have transcended discriminative consciousness. You are no longer aware in terms of unrelated separate parts, but you are aware, you are conscious, here now, fully awake, in terms of the total reality. This great life rhythm, this creative energy, which is in action perpetually, and which is the meaning of love in its supreme sense, is realized by you. You are in the holy state.